The past year proves that a lot of conventional economic wisdom is neither true nor wise. For example, we don't have the money. The power elites tell us it would be nice to do the big-ticket reforms America needs, but the money just isn't there. Then, a pandemic slammed into America, and suddenly trillions of dollars gushed out of Washington for everything from subsidizing meat packers to developing vaccines, revealing that the money is there. We can't increase the federal debt. Yet, Trump and the Republican Congress didn't hesitate to shove the national debt through the roof in 2017 to let a few corporations and billionaires pocket a trillion-dollar tax giveaway. So, if those drunken spenders can use federal borrowing to make the likes of Amazon and Zuckerberg richer, we can borrow funds for such productive national needs as infrastructure investment and quality education for all. The rich are the makers who contribute the most to society. This silly myth quickly melted right in front of us as soon as Senor Coronavirus arrived, making plain that the most valuable people are nurses, grocery clerks, teachers, postal employees, and millions of other mostly low-wage people. So let's capitalize on the moment to demand policies that reward these grassroots makers instead of Wall Street's billionaire takers. Tax cuts drive economic growth for all. They always claim that freeing corporations from the burden of taxes will encourage CEOs to invest in worker productivity, and voila, wages will miraculously rise. This scam has never worked for anyone but the scammers, and it's now obvious to the great majority of workers that the way to increase wages, hello, is to increase wages. This is Jim Hightower saying, percolate up, economics works. Trickle down does not. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So another one of those stories, I look at South Carolina, evidently one of the top Republican operatives in the state, who, you know, all along saying, oh, the COVID's a hoax, it's not real, it's not a big deal, he's dead. And you go, yeah, and I know it's bad for my soul to not care. I know it's bad for my soul to go, you know what, if you were dumb enough not to get vaccinated, if you're dumb enough not to protect yourself, you get what you deserve. And I know that's wrong. And I'll tell you, you know, I've been reading some of the articles lately from doctors who have come out and said, look, you know, I don't blame the people who are unvaccinated who are in front of me. I blame the people who are spreading the misinformation, who are filling their heads with lies and nonsense and BS. You know, doctors and millionaires and people who are trying to profit off of it. And I guess I'm thinking a little bit more in that way, but I'll tell you, it still doesn't make it easier on our healthcare professionals. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what it's really like inside a hospital, what it's really like inside our medical facilities. I've asked our good friend, Dr. Keith Pocheck, to come talk with us. Dr. Keith, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
So, you know, I'm looking at this and, you know, I'm sure you've seen the same kind of articles that I've been seeing. Of doctors like you saying, you know, look, I don't necessarily blame these poor people who were fed tons of misinformation and put into this position by people who are trying to profit off them or politicians who are trying to, you know, stake out a political position. Am I wrong for going, you know, I'm kind of leaning that way now?
No, I think that's the way to look at it, because ultimately a leader is responsible for, you know, the way their team, their followers behave and how they act and what they do. And so, I mean, I agree with you. I tend not to hold it against, you know, the anti-vaccine folks, especially when you know that, you know, maybe their, you know, science is not their line of work. It's not their forte. And you know, you see the Fox News saturation rate in some of the areas of the country and my area included. And you understand really what we're up against and what we've been up against now for a year and a half.
Yeah. But here's the thing, Keith, you know, the reality is I'm not a science guy either. You know, I'll be honest. I did not do well in high school biology. I was not great in chemistry. I wasn't good in those things. Wasn't my interest. But I do defer to people who it is their interest. It is their profession. It is what they know. I do value people of intelligence and people have spent like you. People have spent your career and your entire life focusing on how do you take care of people. I tend to defer to people who know a little bit more than I do.
That's true. I mean, I think that what we're seeing, I mean, this is a bigger symptom, I think, or sign that, you know, we're in the age of the death of expertise. Like, you know, I mean, people are just going to believe what they want, seek out what they want to hear, and not recognize their confirmation bias and ignore the experts. And you know, we've seen that in America now, and the pandemic has highlighted that probably more than anything has in the past 20 years.
Yeah, no, but it's here. I'm somebody who looks at social media, and I go, I believe nothing I see on social media. You know, Facebook, I believe absolutely nothing. Unless there is a verifiable source that I recognize as someone who's not trying to line their pockets with clickbait. And I want to believe that most people are capable of filtering bad information and going, no, and bringing in decent information and somehow having a filtration system that goes out with the bad, we'll hold on to what's reasonable. But I'm afraid that I'm losing that argument.
No, I agree. I think that the internet has lent a shred of credibility to everything on it. And, you know, the Washington Post and One America News look very similar when you know to the average reader who clicks on that. And both of those seem legitimate. And one might be fact checked and one might be willing to issue corrections and retractions and be honest about how they report, and the other doesn't, but they both, because of the internet, they both look legitimate. Yeah. And you know, people can ultimately just, you know, hammer into Google, whatever it is they want to hear. And they're going to find something to validate that.
Yeah. And that's a scary thing. And now I took some heat the other day. Someone emailed me and was very angry with me for saying that Joe Rogan, when he threw the kitchen sink at his COVID with the ivermectin and with the zinc and with I don't know what else he took. I said, look, I mean, here's a guy who's got the best medical advice that you're going to get. He's got the best doctor's money can buy. He's not Bubba or Lugnut going down to the Tractor Supply buying the giant, you know, Econo size of ivermectin and jamming it down his hole. This is somebody who's getting the best care. My concern was not about Joe Rogan, but the message of him saying, oh, we threw the kitchen sink at it, didn't get vaccinated, but we threw the kitchen sink after it when we got it, that sent the wrong message that, you know, we don't need the vaccine, don't care. If I get it, I'm just going to go take all of these. I'm going to take everything. And I'm going, I don't know. You're a medical professional. That a good idea?
Oh, it's awful. No, it's awful. I mean, I think that, you know, the distrust, I think, of the medical system that has been brewing for probably 20 or 30 years or more is no more evident now, or no more evident than it has been now. You know, people now are going to, they're going to take advice from, you know, Facebook, a group of people who they have no idea what their credentials are or what their expertise is and what they actually do for a living. But they're willing to validate that individual person's held belief that, you know, that scientists are wrong and these people are smarter than the scientists and the vaccine is evil and bad and, you know, designed by Bill Gates, whatever else. I mean, you know, you just get the list goes on and on. But the science and the truth has stayed constant. It's still the same. It's like, look at the people who are in trouble with COVID. Look at the people who are in the hospital and dying of COVID. And I mean, these are unvaccinated folks. And in my area of the country, you know, that's hitting us, you know, disproportionately harder than other areas of the country just because of our poor vaccination rates.
And again, it's one of these things that I believe COVID's going to be with us forever. We're not getting rid of it. It's something that we're going to have to figure out how to get past. And the quicker people get vaccinated, the better chance we're going to have to be able to survive through it. And I do believe at some point down the road, it's going to be, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, and I may be, but at some point down the road, we're going to all have to figure out how, you know, just like the flu, every year we go get a flu shot. Every couple of years, you're going to have to get a booster. We're going to have to figure out how to live with this. I don't see any more lockdowns. I don't see the appetite to close schools down again. I think we're going to have to figure out how to power through this. And yeah, people are going to die because of it, because we're just not the society that cares about anybody else.
No, and I said this, I think, you know, I've been on with you a few times, and a year or a year and a half ago, I said, what this is going to highlight is Americans' lack of patience and stamina to be able to handle, you know, a pandemic like this that's going to challenge us really in the sense of we're going to have to run the marathon on this. It's not going to be a sprint. And that's probably one of the most accurate things that, and I'm frequently wrong, but that's one of the most accurate things I've said about this, is that like our patience and stamina was not there. You look at how other countries, our patience, our stamina, and our deference to experts are abysmal compared to a lot of other countries. And that's why we're in the situation we're in right now.
It's weird to me though. You know, I know a number of people who they're contrarians. No matter what you tell them, no matter what the quote-unquote experts know, no matter what the facts are, they're going to say that's a conspiracy, that it's all made up, that there's something nefarious going on. Because I do believe some people are wired in such a way that you're never going to reach them. They're always going to be anti-whatever. Whatever's going on, because I think it comes back down to this need for attention, this need to be special, this need to know something. Even if they don't, and even if they're wrong, but they're the loudest in the group. They're the most vocal in the group. They're the most assertive in the group, and they're never wrong because ultimately they believe.
Exactly. Yeah. And so this is the curse of confirmation bias. It's like you can have 10,000 doctors who will willfully take to social media or post videos of you know the science behind the vaccines and tell you about how they're safe, and there'll be one other physician who will fly in the face of that, and you get this both sidesism, and all of a sudden those two opinions carry the same weight when it's 10,000 versus one. And that's where we are in America, this both sidesism in America. It's like, you know, no, those opinions are not equal just because you found a doctor, you know, somewhere in Brambleweed, Idaho, who is against the vaccine. I mean, that's just not the way science works. Sure, you found the guy and he'll get on YouTube and he'll talk about how it's a hoax and COVID's a hoax and the vaccine's a hoax. But that doesn't undo the science. That doesn't do the expert opinion of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of other scientists.
Yeah. And what's amazing, when they do come out and say that it's all bad and it's all a hoax, they always seem to have some kind of snake oil they want to sell you, that they have the real answer. And this is where I, you know, when I read this latest doctor, he wrote an article in the San Francisco Chronicle a couple of days ago. And as I was reading through his article, I'm going, you know, you look on the right wing, you know, politically, they're always selling some kind of supplement, some beet juice or some kind of snake oil to tell you, no, this is how we're going to take care of it. Silver or magic blankets or buckets that you put your head in. I don't know what scams they continue to run, but it's always about you giving them money to buy things that questionably are not going to do anything, but possibly could hurt you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Now it's Betadine. It was Ivermectin. I think Ivermectin is now starting to finally fall out of favor, amazingly. And now it's the iodine solution, you know, that they use as a surgical scrub. I don't know if you've seen this. You know, when you're prepping a patient for surgery,
that red stuff?
Yeah, the orange red.
Oh my God. People aren't drinking that, are they?
People are gargling that now. Oh yeah, that's the new COVID cure. a quote unquote COVID cure. Please don't do that, people. Just like, you know, get the vaccine. But that's the new one. And I guess probably maybe the price of that will go up and some people are hoarding it and are making money off of it. But
oh my gosh. I mean, but you know, here's the thing. And there's part of me that goes, you know what? Take as much ivermectin as you want. And you know, let the fun begin. You play stupid games, win stupid prizes. I mean, that's all I can come up with. I mean, there's a moment where you go, just we got to thin the herd somehow. And if it means you're basically expelling your guts out of a small orifice in your body, maybe that's what we have to do.
Well, it's true, but then sitting where I sit, you feel so much for the healthcare teams, you know, who are there dealing with that, as well as, you know, there are obviously legitimate emergencies that you see. And you read stories of people getting turned away from dozens of hospitals who's having some sort of cardiac emergency and there's no cardiac ICU in hundreds of miles and that person dies. Or, you know, you read of the person who had a gallstone pancreatitis, completely fixable condition, time sensitive, but completely fixable. That person is going to walk out of the hospital generally within a couple of days. And they couldn't get the guy anywhere and he died, you know, and he's 50 some years old. And so that's, you know, that's the reality that we're in right now. And a lot of folks have been talking about this for years and years, Rick, that, you know, our hospital surge capacity is really poor. And it took a pandemic to really get America to really pay attention on that. You know, if it's a hurricane, if it's a mass casualty shooting event, if it's a flood, that's a localized emergency. And, you know, you can usually divert, or you can get people out away from, you know, harm's way and into different hospitals. When you have a global pandemic that affects literally everywhere in the world and every hospital in America, a lot of instances, that now that doesn't exist anymore, that strategy of just getting people out of the way and in the safer areas. And that's what we're seeing. And so the surge capacity of American hospitals, the problem there that we've had now for years and years and years that a lot of folks have been harping on, is now evident, I think, to rank and file Americans.
Yeah, but again, you go back to the beginning of this, and this is where I started, you know, right at the beginning of this pandemic, saying we don't want to blow out our healthcare capacity. Because once you fill up all the beds with people who have COVID, then you're going to be searching around. The guy, I guess he was from Mississippi, Alabama. They looked to 43 different hospitals in three states and could not find him a bed anywhere. And he ended up dying of something that was something that, you know, 2 years ago, he'd have been okay. All because we're just not doing the right things. And, you know, for me, there's one, I look at the fact that we got a bunch of stupid people playing stupid games, but two, we've privatized our healthcare system to the point to where we've profitized it down to shrinking the number of beds. We've got bean counters instead of doctors running things. Our healthcare system is now a profit motive thing instead of a wellness thing. And for me, we're at a moment, I hope, and I'm hoping somebody brings this up, that we reclaim our community hospitals, that we invest in community hospitals and stop with this profitization of healthcare.
And I think that could be a silver lining that comes out of this. You know, maybe smaller health systems and smaller, you know, those individual hang a shingle doctor's offices can come back because of this. That'd be great to see. I hope it happens that way. But you know, I mean, right now, you know, healthcare workers are struggling as a whole. And I think now what we've seen is that for years and years and years, health systems have staffed hospitals and have staffed clinics to be able to handle the lowest volume days and then expected them to just adapt and, you know, and take on the high volume days and ride it out and get through that. And now for 18 months, it's been every day has been peak flu season. And, you know, folks are having a tough time. So if you know any healthcare workers or, you know, nurses or medical assistants or rad techs or, you know, physicians or PAs or MPs, just realize kind of what they're going through right now. And you know, a few months ago, heroes worked here, and now you know, we get yelled at.
No, and that's terrible. And look, I'm with our doctors and our nurses and the support staff and all the people who have to put up with this and clean up the messes and all of that. My heart is with them. I wish them the best, and I hope they're doing the good work. Folks like you, I give nothing but credit to, Keith. But I appreciate you taking some time with us, sharing your stories and your expertise. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again for having me. Yeah, anytime.
Anytime. Good stuff. Our good friend, Dr. Keith Pocheck. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Is it too much? Is it too much to think that people should protect themselves? I don't think so. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the day 350,000 GM workers kicked off a 67-day strike. It was the largest auto strike since the end of World War II. According to historian Jefferson Cowie, it was likely the costliest. In his book, Stayin' Alive, Cowie notes that the strike cost GM $1 billion in profits and nearly bankrupted the union. But he adds it, quote, lacked the proletarian drama that fired journalists' hearts. For Cowie, it was an example of labor management cooperation, a civilized affair. But historian Jeremy Breacher points out that the Wall Street Journal drew different conclusions about the strike at the time. In a series of articles, the paper noted that labor management cooperation during the strike served ironically to get workers back to work. A long and costly strike served a number of functions. It wore down strikers' expectations. After 8 or 10 weeks, workers would be amiable to terms they initially rejected. It also provided an escape valve for built-up frustration over working conditions. And a long strike served to coalesce internal union factions around a common enemy, strengthening the union's leadership in the process. For management, a long and costly strike lent hope that workers would be reluctant to strike in the future. But Breacher notes these ideas about workers' motives nearly backfired. Strikers simply wouldn't budge on their demands. They made gains in wages, pensions, and cost of living allowances. And they were finally able to retire after 30 years. But critics argued the agreement fell short of initial demands, and workers lacked more say in the workplace. This would be a key issue in the many strikes and wildcats in the years to come. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
One of my favorite people on the planet right there. I got to tell you, Keith is a real salt of the earth guy. And a good doctor. Somebody that I respect. And to be honest, he's been spot on all along in his advice and his view on how we deal with this. And look, you know, as we said there a moment ago, from the beginning, this wasn't about, all of our children are going to die and everyone's going to die from it. No, we're going to have a percentage of people to die, especially grandma and grandpa. They're the most vulnerable. You know, our senior population, people with pre-existing conditions, people with breathing problems, they were always the ones we were looking out for. So when I hear these people going, no, we need to unmask our children. I want to see their beautiful smiles. You go, well, I guess, you know, potentially you don't want to see grandma and grandpa anymore. Because ultimately, you know, that's the sacrifice. Kids will get it, and kids will get through it. The vast majority, their immune systems will get them through. The question is what happens long term? Is this something that becomes reoccurring? We don't know. There's so much we don't know. If my kid got it, does he now have a pre-existing condition that in years to come will boomerang back? I look at myself every year. I get an upper respiratory infection every year. It's like clockwork. It is what it is. It's one of those things that, you know, for as long as I can remember, I've had it. Some years I get through it on my own. Some years it gets really, really bad. I got to go to the doctor. They give me an antibiotic. It clears up in a couple of days. Interestingly enough, that antibiotic keeps getting stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. What used to start off as one E-myosin, I got the pronunciation wrong, and someone corrected me that it was a different drug. It's E-myosin is what it was told to me to be. I don't even know that they make that anymore. It's supposedly that weak. We're now up to the Z-pack of something else I can't pronounce. But what's happened is the bug has gotten stronger. And this is the same thing with this virus. It's going to continue to mutate. It's going to continue to get stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And we're going to keep fighting this battle. This is a whack-a-mole game. And this is one of those things where tolerance, understanding, compassion, decency, those are important words. Kicking and screaming like a child in the cereal aisle, not a good thing. Not helpful in any way. We're going to fly in October, and I'm dreading the occasion, because which Carl and Karen is going to throw a temper tantrum about wearing a mask, and are they going to be sitting next to me? And then do we have a problem? You know, this is that time where we should be, as a community, going, you know, how do we make sure each of us are taken care of, are safe, are how do we respect each other? Instead of going, mine, my right. It's my right to hack and cough all over you. It's my right to spew and spittle and all that stuff. How do we get through that? Because understand, you know, this isn't going away anytime soon. I've never believed we were going to completely eradicate it, tap it down, control it, possibly. Contact tracing, where we have outbreaks, we do some quarantining, some segregation stuff, make sure that it doesn't explode into a bigger thing. But when you've got governors like in Texas and in Florida and other places, the South, who don't seem to really care. Do you remember when Donald Trump said, when it gets hot, it's going to just go away? Remember that? Remember when the heat comes, it'll go away on its own. One day we won't even know it's gone. It's just going to go. If that's the case, because it is stinking hot in the South, how come it's not going away? Now, the right answer, the thoughtful answer, is because, well, in the South, it's stinking freaking hot. And everyone's going inside where the air conditioning is, where the air is recirculated, and you end up potentially being in a colder environment and confined, where, you know, all the germs will, you know, people unmasked, spittling all over each other, will then share each other's germs. That's generally the sane, rational, thoughtful argument. But I get it's all a hoax still. I get the, well, you know, just people with weak immune systems. Or my favorite. Oh, it's my favorite. It's the people who don't believe in Jesus. Which is weird to me. Just weird to me. Look, I believe, I do, but I don't think Jesus is going to protect you from COVID. Just like he's not going to protect you if you step out on the street in front of a bus. I don't think he's swooping down to push you out of the way. That's not going to happen. You can be drenched in the blood of whatever. The bus isn't just going to go right around you. And, you know, I'm in this spot where common decency, common respect, thoughtfulness, something we should think about. I know it's a lot to ask for. I know. I'm with you. It's a lot. But I believe. I love that line. It's my favorite. I believe that we can do this. I do. I have faith. I have faith in humanity and in you. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
Rick waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Forecasters say the storm could dump up to 20 inches of rain over some parts of the Gulf Coast this week.
Second monster storm in 2 weeks drowns the U.S. Gulf Coast.
When we build back, we have to build back better. It's not a Democrat thing. It's not a Republican thing. It's a weather thing.
Biden urges Congress to invest in hardening the nation's infrastructure. Plus, another nail in the coffin for the massive zombie pebble mine in Alaska.
All of those coffins and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You know, we can't continue to try to ignore reality.
Oh, Mr. President, as Barack Obama used to say, yes, we can. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, yet another monster storm and yet another record hurricane season is yet again knocking out power across Texas and Louisiana.
Yes, as we go to air, Tropical Storm Nicholas is bringing days of heavy rain and dangerous flash floods to areas of Texas and storm-battered Louisiana. States of emergency are in effect. Widespread power outages are reported in Texas, again, after the ice storm earlier this year. Flights canceled and schools are closed. The National Hurricane Center warns that Nicholas is a slow-moving rainmaker that could dump as much as 20 inches of rain on some parts of the Gulf Coast.
20 inches of rain.
Yes. And that compounds storm surge with inland flooding. Inland flooding is the leading cause of storm-related deaths. Beleaguered Louisiana is still struggling to recover from a direct hit by Category 4 Hurricane Ida just 2 weeks ago. Studies show that human-caused climate change is making storms more severe, producing more rainfall, moving slower once they make landfall, and generating larger storm surges along the coast.
None of which is good news.
It's a busy week on Capitol Hill as Democrats hash out key pillars of President Biden's climate agenda in his Build Back Better proposal to create jobs, upgrading the nation's infrastructure, and shifting to clean energy.
That would be good.
It's part of the Democrats' $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation legislation that can pass with a simple majority over an expected Republican filibuster. The bill also includes funding for lead pipe removal, fees for methane leaks, transmission upgrades, and EV charging infrastructure. And under negotiation right now is a potentially game-changing policy called the Clean Electricity Performance Program, or CEPP, to incentivize utilities to accelerate the shift to clean energy. A new report from independent firm Analysis Group finds that if Congress passes the Clean Electricity Performance Program, it would create nearly 8 million new jobs and add nearly $1 trillion to the economy by 2031.
That's good thing if we could just get that message across to Joe Manchin, who really doesn't seem to like any of this stuff.
President Biden visited the wildfire-ravaged states of California and Idaho on Monday to bolster firefighting efforts and promote his Build Back Better proposal. At the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho, and then again in California, Biden emphasized that man-made climate change is here and the nation needs to prepare now for worse effects to come, noting that last year alone, extreme weather cost the U.S. $99 billion.
The reality is we have a global warming problem. It's not like you can build back to what it was before. It's not going to get any better than it is today. It only can get worse. For every dollar we invest in resilience, that is building back better, we save $6 down the road in the future. When we build back, we have to build back better. It's not a Democrat thing. It's not a Republican thing. It's a weather thing.
Actually, it's a climate thing, Mr. President, but We'll let you go on that one.
Some good news. The Biden Environmental Protection Agency says it will establish the first ever rules limiting the industrial dumping of toxic chemicals known as PFAS into public water systems or directly into rivers, lakes, and surface waters.
Tyrant.
PFAS are linked to a host of health impacts like cancers and birth defects. EPA will also establish new rules limiting wastewater discharges from slaughterhouses into rivers, like the Smithfield Hog Processing Plant in North Carolina, which alone dumps more than 1 million pounds of pollutants a year directly into the Cape Fear River.
Well, so much for freedom.
Finally, the Biden EPA has also put another nail in the coffin of the extremely controversial Pebble Mine, a truly massive open-pit gold and copper mine proposed in Alaska, which the EPA's studies have shown would irreversibly harm the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery in Alaska's pristine Bristol Bay watershed. The Biden EPA has asked a federal court to allow it to reopen its proposed veto of the mine under the Clean Water Act.
Well, let's hope this one sticks for a while. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, former House Speaker Denny Hastert evidently has reached an agreement to pay something, they didn't say how much, to the person who accused him of sexually abusing him as a child. There's no real news there to me for that. What was the story for me is the U.S. District Judge, who evidently told Hastert there's nothing more stunning than to have the word serial child molester and Speaker of the House in the same sentence. That kind of caught my attention. But there you go. So I guess Denny's getting his life back together. And I guess, okay for him? Yeah, I kind of worry about those kids, though. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So, yesterday's recall, kind of a blowout.
A big blowout. And people are saying that, and I think it's got to be looked at, and there'll be people, professionals, are going to analyze this, Rick, but a lot of people are saying, well, it's because Elder was the alternative to become the governor. And I don't think it's all Elder. I think, you know, part of it is because they injected Larry Elder into the scene, and he's not popular. And so that's a part of it. But I think it basically, you know, laid upon the direction that the governor was going with COVID and where the people of California wanted to be there, you know, on the issue. Because I think it's just, just not sound policy to just say, well, it really wasn't the COVID, it was all Elder. You know, I think a great portion of it was also the COVID policies and again where the people came down on it. But it was big for Newsom. I'm not sure that it has the sweeping broad brush now, though, that this is how it's going to be across the entire country. But I think also it's maybe a wake up call. California does this every gubernatorial term somebody.
It's getting to the point where, you know, we had a guest on yesterday who was saying it's just too easy to recall a governor.
Right.
And I don't want, I want there to be, if someone's really bad, I want there to be a path forward. But because a bunch of rich people decide we're going to throw some money into gathering some signatures and pushing forward on something like this for whatever reason, I don't know. I think it's too easy to go and undo what the ballot box has decided.
But this is the problem with recalls, in particular in California, because you hit the nail on the head. You know, a couple of rich people can get together. Maybe one goes against a Democrat governor. Maybe one goes against a Republican governor. Who knows? But they can get unhappy, and they want to divert the attention of real issues. So, you know, they spend a ton of money, hire people. They run out and get the signatures, and here you go.
Yeah.
And I agree. I mean, we don't have recall in Ohio. We have elections in my home state. And I've always been, you know, I'm pleased with that. Some states have recall, some don't. I just think it makes a situation where you can get this happening every couple of years, and It just takes a lot of time away from everything.
Yeah, and you're right. And what it does is it stops everything else. So if you wanted to gum up the system even worse, this is what you end up doing. And it seems like, though, and you said, you know, going after Republican governors or Democratic governors, it seems like they're only going after Democratic governors, because I don't remember the last time a Republican was recalled. Do you?
Well, I think, didn't they go after Schwarzenegger out there?
I thought there was talk of it, but I didn't think they actually went through
Maybe
a recall vote.
Did I they? Know it started after Reagan, and I should know the history of this, and I don't, but I think recall motions start after that. Now, whether they got to the point of getting the signatures, they may not have.
Yeah, I now got to think about
that. We got to look at the history, exactly.
Now, I know Arnold Schwarzenegger was in the movie Total Recall.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I saw that. I saw that movie.
I don't know that he was totally recalled. He wasn't recalled, but I don't know there was a vote. But I will look that up. And I hope one of our listeners sends me a message to keep us up to date on this. Do want to move along. Big bombshell yesterday came out in the book that General Milley had some conversations with the Chinese, you know, working behind the scenes to not let Trump, you know, nuke anything. We got a problem with that?
I've been talking about this all day long. I have read that story and other stories, but that particular story about four or five times. To me, it's one of the most chilling news accounts I've probably read in the last 10 to 15 years of anything. And I've read some, you know, pretty chilling accounts of different items. This one's so bothersome and so troublesome in so many ways of what we potentially got to the brink of. And here's the problem with this. September the 28th, he goes to, General Milley goes to, I think it's the Senate first, something. And I disagree with that. This issue is so critical, so important, so disturbing that I think that the intel agency tomorrow, Democrat and Republican, behind closed doors, and eventually, yes, results can be told, but they need to do this in a non-public dog and pony fiasco, and the Republicans say, oh, he's a traitor, he's a liar. They need to find out what has happened. Were we on the brink of a potential disaster for this country, of a potential nuclear war that, you know, would have been used to divert attention, and way beyond that would have changed our country for decades to come? And I think they need to ask, you know, the solid questions, know where the information is, then go ahead and take it public. I'm just afraid, Rick, that this becomes, you know, before they get there, it becomes the politicization, you know, they're after former President Trump, and the facts don't get out there. So yeah. I think they ought to do a little research, then go ahead and bring it to the light of day. But I don't see why they should wait till the 28th and then have the public hearings. Do it. Intel has every right to do it, every ability to do this.
No, I'm there with you. Now, do you agree with retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who said that Milley's got to resign? Quote, he usurped civilian authority, broke chain of command, and violated the sacrosanct principle of civilian control over the military. He said it's an extremely dangerous precedent, and you can't simply walk away from that. I got to tell you that, you know, I there's that moment where when I first read this, I'm going, you know, I get that you had to restrain Trump a little bit, and then I had to step back and go, I'm struggling with that, because if you're going to do it for Trump, you're going to do it for other people. I don't know. I'm comfortable with that.
I have a lot of questions on this story. I think it's serious. I think it's chilling in multiple ways, either chilling towards Trump or chilling with the fact that if something did happen, that the Chinese would have been called if something happened. There's a lot of questions to be answered. I'm not so sure I can agree with the military assessment that he should resign at this point in time, because, see, there's part of the problem. I don't know.
I don't either, and that's why I'm asking you. Who spent years in Congress. You're someone who's dealt with people at this high level. You know better than I do what their parameters are, what they're capable of, what they're supposed to do. Because, you know, look, if you're the head of the Joint Chief of Staff, you know, I think, you know, keeping us from nuclear war, especially needlessly, is probably somewhere in your job description. Maybe,
right.
No?
Right. And, I mean, the old thing, you know, you turn the keys. If you don't turn the key at the same time, you shoot the guy and get somebody that will turn the keys. Which, by the way, there's a lot of truth to that, how they do these things,
right.
You know, once the codes are activated. And, you know, that's always been the, you know, set in motion thought. Well, there's other pieces to it, too. And, again, you know, should he step in? I don't know. I'm torn on the story, but the problem remains and should be answered. You know, what was the situation in the White House and what should happen? What should the safeguards be on the other end with the military? And again, I think if we just start with, well, he had to resign, he was a traitor or this or that, I'm not sure that's the way to approach it. They need to get, you know, down precise, extreme details on this and figure this thing out of who did what and who should have done something or not done something.
No, I got to tell you, I'm sticking with my initial reaction that he's a patriot. He's someone who saw a danger and he was saving this country from disaster, because nobody could imagine. Look, you got a guy who wanted to nuke a hurricane, and you could say, "Oh, that was a joke. He was just being funny." There's nothing funny about that. It's not something you joke about when you're the most powerful man on the planet, and there's questions of your what you're going to do with our nuclear arsenal. I don't know that I'm disagreeing with him taking some actions to provide a little buffer. I don't know.
Right. I'm in the same direction. That's why I said, you know, nobody should call upon him to resign. That's
okay.
Not in the purview of these retired people. Well, he needs to resign. I don't know. But they need to vet this at the highest levels, which is the Intel Committee, with the Republicans and Democrats present, and somebody from the leadership team of both parties present. They need to vet it out. They need to find out how far this thing was going to go. Look, if Trump had launched nukes on Iran or China, I mean, the bottom line is, for what reason? I mean, answer that. For what reason would it even be considered? For what reason? You know, there was no intel telling us that they were going to do that to us.
Right.
So, you know, I know there's chains of commands, et cetera, but for people now to call upon him to resign, I think is just absolute premature. It's going to, you know, get that drum beating out there that he's a traitor and he's treasonous, et cetera. And I'm not sure that's the case. And that's why I think, you know, don't do the dog and pony bit at this point in time. Get him in there. Get the necessary people that need to be in there and find out exactly, you know, what happened. This is according to the book, but I think there's a lot of reality here.
Yeah. No, I'm
sure.
I think it's something. But I do think it has to be public. I think we need to get a definitive answer on what happened and how it happened and define some roles here. Just my view. I wanted to get your thoughts on North Korea. Evidently, they've got a missile train. Evidently, they've got a train that they can launch missiles from.
Well, North Korea is always, you know, going to launch something, and we've tried every which way under the sun to deal with them. And I don't know. It's the hermit kingdom. We really don't have, I think, precise intel sometimes out of there of what they're really capable of doing. And, of course, it's a definite problem for that area of the world, you know, Japan and obviously South Korea. So, again, we can look at them. I think the key to containing them is China. Any pressure that the world can put upon China, I think that is the key to containing them.
Yeah, no, we got to do something most certainly on the China front as well. I wanted to get your thoughts on this story of the three former U.S. intelligence officers. Evidently, they paid a little fine, a little slap on the wrist, a couple of bucks, over 3 years of violating U.S. hacking laws for the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. Paid a little fine, no jail time.
Yeah, you know, I always look at this and I think of people I know and, you know, let's see. If Rick Smith did this, what would you be eating in the main line of the federal corrections, you know, for the next, 10 years, shall we say, plus the fine? If anybody did this, I'm looking at this and here, you know, what do they have on the United States government as blackmail? I'm going to throw that out there. You've got three former U.S. intel officers. They're paying $1.7 million, oh, big deal. You know, how much did they make in penalties over those 3 years? They admitted to violating the U.S. hacking and export laws while employed by where? The United Arab Emirates. And then there was a line in the story about, you know, hackers, and we're going to go after them. Mark Lesko, the acting assistant attorney general for Justice Department, we're going to go after them. They're going to be prosecuted. No, these are like the banksters now. You do wrong, you just pay a fine. Don't worry about jail time. Anybody else in this country besides these three would be, you know, eating prison food for a decade. Anybody else in this country.
Yeah, I mean, this is another one of those stories where you go, you know, the average everyday working stiff, you know, they look at what's being presented to them, and it's no wonder they look at our government with a jaundiced eye.
Well, let me put it like this. An average person walks down the street, they go in a store, and they shoplift. And they shoplift maybe $100 worth of stuff. They'll do more time than these three.
No, absolutely. And there was a guy in Philadelphia who took 3 peppermint patties, spent over 500 days in jail.
Right. So I find this unconscionable. I can't understand. I wish the media would dig into this. Why do they not have jail time? And why is the penalty for what they did, which was extreme against companies, and they did it on behalf of the United Arab Emirates, why are they only paying $1.7 million? I think they got somebody blackmailed.
No, they have to. If not all of the companies and our government, they got something all right.
Something.
I wanted to get your thoughts on this story of, you know, the Republicans are looking at the southern border, looking at the Afghan refugees coming in, fleeing the Taliban. There seems to be the messaging there that the Republicans want to put forth. You think it's the wrong move. Why?
It's the wrong move because if they want to argue about the Mexican border and they want to argue about undocumented, or they call me illegals, they want to argue about that, about people coming in the country who don't have documentation. That's one issue in itself that, you know, has been and will be argued about. But right now, there's a handful of former Trump officials that are making a definite, pointed effort to oppose Afghan refugees who are fleeing the Taliban. Now, the ringleader for this, of course, is Miller.
Yep.
You know, that's the
Stephen
name
Miller.
That we Stephen Miller. We need to remember Stephen Miller worked for, at that time, Congressman Shattuck when I was in the House, and he has opposed legal immigration. He did everything with Trump to stop legal immigration, including visas and visitors' visas. I mean, the guy is completely out of control. We haven't even gotten to undocumented. On this one, he's beating this drum, and these are, you know, the Republicans have said, oh, we've got to get the Americans out and the Afghans helped us. And now all of a sudden, are they going to let Miller turn this into where, you know, these people helped us, but we're not going to bring them here? Is that what they really, really want to do? I think this is a major mistake. And I believe that they are absolutely, if they do this, they're taking the wrong path for this. And I've got to believe most people want these refugees to be helped and to be taken care of, and people are upset that, you know, more in fact haven't been issued the visas to come here. I think it's the wrong approach, and this is all being driven, and guess what, Stephen Miller's going to make some money off this. Okay, some think tank, some lobbyist, somebody's going to pay him.
They always do.
Somebody.
It's amazing how they always do. Last thing I wanted to ask you about, we're about ready to bump up against the debt ceiling, and this is one of those things that, you know, we talk about it every time it gets here. Is there anything the Republicans can do to stop Democrats from raising the debt ceiling?
Not really. I mean, look, when Trump was the smartest on this. I've got to give it to Trump on this one. He just did away with it for 2 years.
Right.
Man, the media didn't say anything. He just they did it. Let's just kind of put it on ice for 2 years, literally. When Bush was president, people would say something, give some floor speeches. They would put their voting machine in the card. I called it the yawn vote. They yawned and went to dinner. When Barack Obama became president, this was the end of the world. Every one of these was the end of the world.
Yep.
This, the debt ceiling, that is money that is spent, and then you raise the debt ceiling. If they want to, you know, be fiscally sound, then take care of the budgets before it gets to the debt ceiling vote. And so this will make it, you know, they'll kick the can, you know, down the road. They're not going to stop the government dead in its tracks. So it, you know, it will make it. But they'll build this into a, you know, end of the world case. It's been going on, you know, forever about raising the debt ceiling because they've already voted to spend the money.
So there's no Armageddon coming. There's no end of the fiscal world on the horizon.
No.
Going to be okay. And I got to be honest, at some point, yeah, Biden got us out of Afghanistan, ended that, pulled the Band-Aid right off. Good. Can we just pull the Band-Aid off and get rid of this debt ceiling? Because clearly we're not going to stop spending money. And the debt ceiling does nothing but cause crisis. Again, we should be arguing at the beginning, like you said, before you spend the money.
Sure. Before we spend it. And the media loves to build this, we're to the edge, and they make it all dramatic, and then they step in, and we all know they're going to do it. It's going to be extended. But again, how can you say this is the fiscal way to solve the problem? No, the fiscal way, if they want to be responsible in their own minds or their own images, then do it before it gets to the debt ceiling level. That's where you argue it, not now.
Not right there. I'm right there with you. And how we pay our bills is we tax the rich and use that money to pay off our bills. But, Bob, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney. And look, here's the reality. If you're really hell-bent on you care about the debt and the deficit, as Joe Manchin now claims he does, if that's the reality, you now care, how about paying the bill? And we do that by going after the very wealthy who have shirked their responsibility for decades. We now know the Treasury Department came out with a report, said, look, there's $600 billion a year on the table that the very wealthy and well-to-do have stuffed into their pockets and their offshore tax havens and under the mattress or wherever they store it that they didn't pay taxes on. They've got armies of tax avoidance lawyers out there trying to use every loophole available, even ones that they're not entitled to just squeeze our government a little bit more. So we can't do things. We can't pay our bills. And what the argument then comes down to, no, see, Rick, what we got to do is what we do at the kitchen table. Tighten the belt. Stop the spending. Stop spending on education and health care, and stop spending on programs to help the poor and the needy. Stop spending on feeding children school lunches, because it'll just make them dependent. It's a slippery slope, right? Once they get used to eating, well, they're not going to want to give it up. So don't feed them, and they'll get used to being hungry, and they'll be hungry, and they'll work harder, pull themselves up by proverbial bootstraps that they don't have. That's the narrative, right? It's a nonsense narrative, but it's one that some buy. And it never seems out of range when the Republicans go, no, we need to give corporations more. We need to give the wealthy more. They need it. Those children living in the car with their parents? No. That homeless veteran? No, we can't possibly. No. But another tax break for corporate America? We've always got time for that. Another handout, another welfare payment to Jeff Bezos. We always got time for that. We've always got money for that, because they're the job creators. They're the innovators. And if we don't give them the money, they won't create the jobs, which is just nuts. Because, I say a lot of times, capitalism will solve our problems. The moneyed interests, people chasing the dollars, will figure it out. COVID, the money, capitalism will figure COVID out. And the people who have been touting capitalism for a very long time, going to be interesting watching them turn into socialists. Just my thought. But lots of stuff to get to and lots of fun on the horizon. And this is just part of it. For me, you want to talk about our debt ceiling? Let's talk about paying the bill. I pay my bills every month. And when I don't have enough money, I work a little bit more. I bring in some more revenue. It's what we need to do. Bring in a little bit more revenue. We need to make sure we can pay our bills so we can support our society. Just my thought. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Make sure you follow us on Twitter @ricksmithshow. Facebook, give us a like while you're there. Check out our YouTube page. Subscribe. Give us a thumbs up as well. All good stuff. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Again, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.